Since 1775, generations of Americans have fought for our ideals and our principles. American warriors secured the freedoms to create the United States of America. They fought to end slavery. They joined with allies to win two world wars. They have responded with valor and honor whenever called. And they have liberated more people around the globe than any military in the history of the world. Our all-volunteer forces of guardsmen, soldiers, sailors, marines, airmen, and reservists continue the mission begun at Lexington and Concord. Less than 1% of Americans serve in our armed forces. The least the rest of us can do is to pay attention and get engaged. This program is produced and broadcast for that purpose. It is presented live and worldwide at 1041kqth.com. To engage, call 520-751-1041. The American Warrior is on the air.
Hello, folks. Your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, here on American Warrior Radio. We are live and worldwide today. Our phone lines are open, 751-1041. On March 20th, 2005, Leanne Hester was a 23-year-old member of the Kentucky Army National Guard. She was assigned to the 617th Military Police Company. Sergeant Hester was part of a squad of two women and eight men whose assignment was to search convoy routes for improvised explosive devices and provide additional security for the truck convoys. The convoy was transiting near Salman Pak, Iraq, when it was ambushed by an estimated 50 insurgents with heavy machine guns, small arms, and rocket-propelled grenades. What was supposed to be an ambush quickly turned into a bad day for the insurgents. Hester led her team through the kill zone and into a flanking position. From there, she assaulted the enemy's trench line with grenades and M203 grenade launcher rounds. Then she and her squad leader, Sergeant Timothy Nine, assaulted two more entrenched positions. During the second assault, Sergeant Hester was credited with personally killing three insurgents. When the battle ended, 27 insurgents were dead, 6 wounded, and 1 captured. The U.S. forces suffered 3 soldiers injured. For her actions that day, Sergeant Leanne Hester became the first female soldier since World War II to be awarded the Silver Star and the first ever to be cited for valor in close quarters combat. I bring that up today because in December of last year, Defense Secretary Ashton Carter announced that the Pentagon would open all military combat jobs to women. At a news conference, Carter said there will be no exceptions. They'll be allowed to drive tanks, fire mortars, and lead infantry soldiers into combat. They'll be able to serve as Army Rangers and Green Berets, Navy SEALs, Marine Corps infantry, and Air Force parajumpers, and everything else that was previously only open to men. That decision opened about 220,000 additional military roles to women. Now, let's be clear about this. Women have served in combat. The example I just read to you shows that, and particularly given the asymmetric nature of our wars and the battles we're fighting nowadays, not serving in a combat position does not mean one will not find themselves under fire and engage with the enemy, and women have proven themselves very adept at that. Women are an integral part of our nation's defense and are growing in those roles, but Secretary Carter's announcement reopened a long debate between what is fair and what is best for our military. Joining us today to share his opinion and some light on this issue is Marshall McGurk. Marshall recently retired as an officer in the United States Army Special Forces. He's a Ranger. He's a West Point graduate, served as an infantry platoon leader during Operation Iraqi Freedom, and as a Special Forces Detachment Commander during Operation Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan. Marshall has written about this issue, and American Warrior Radio is pleased to have him join us today. Marshall, welcome back, I guess, to American Warrior Radio.
Thanks, Ben. How are you?
Now,
great to be with you again.
Were you the one that was beating me up about the whole Danger Zone introductory music, or is that one of your other Havoc Journal buddies?
I think that was one of the other writers, but I'm all about Danger Zone. That's a good track.
Okay, well, Marshall, let's get right into this, and let's start by clarifying how did we get, and I want to be very clear here. I don't want to talk today about women in combat, because women have been in combat. They continue to be in combat. They've been killed. They've been wounded. This is more, I guess, a focus on perhaps the Special Forces, but how did we get here? Did Secretary Carter just wake up one morning and decide when I was shaving, oh, let's do this?
No, this has been a long-going issue, especially over the last 15 years since we've been at war with Iraq and Afghanistan. And it goes all the way back to, you know, Vietnam and the Gulf War as well. But it's not necessarily, like you said, Ben, that the issue is not women in combat, because once you're deployed overseas, there's really, you know, nowadays with the fight, there's really no front line, and the enemy could be anywhere. So you could be called upon, you know, to take offensive action at any point with your weapon, and everybody's trained to do so. But it's women in combat roles, specifically serving in the Ranger Regiment, serving in the Navy SEAL, serving in the Army Special Forces. Those jobs were previously closed to women, and so His announcement and the subsequent action in January 2016 actually opened up all those jobs without exception.
Well, and maybe it's that without exception part we want to talk about. Now, I want to be very clear to our listeners. They might be expecting a certain kind of discussion today, but I think they'll be surprised. And let me sort of introduce it, Marshall, by reading from one of your articles on Havoc Journal. The debate on women in combat is an emotional one, filled with anger and vitriol across both sides of the aisle. A rational, calm, and clear perspective is needed to ascertain the facts. This debate can move forward, indeed it can end, if everyone, men, women, service members, politicians, flag officers, and the media, agree on two things. First, we must acknowledge this is not a debate about women in combat. Women already serve and actively participate in combat operations. I served with a cultural support team who received combat action badges for multiple firefights and IED incidents. Once we accept this fact, the second fact becomes apparent. This is not about women in combat. This is a debate about allowing women to serve in military occupational specialties directly related to kinetic combat operations. Upon accepting the two aforementioned facts, the argument becomes incredibly simple. Women want to be able to volunteer for the same MOS as men. They want the same chance to serve in the infantry on tanks as forward observers, as special warfare boat operators, and forward air controllers. And then you wrap up by saying, you know, women want an equal opportunity to sacrifice for, in service to her country. She wants an equal opportunity to die. That's a pretty strong ending phrase there, Marshall. Tell us kind of what you intended by that.
What I intended by that was that it really what it comes down to, I served in the active duty military for 11 years. I continued to serve in the Army Reserve, and my comments are in no way, you know, directly related to Department of Defense policy. But the women that I did serve with in all over the world, all over the United States, they wanted the option. They wanted the option available. They wanted the option to refuse, you know, to serve into combat arms and choose to serve in another branch of service that was, you know, likely service support. And there was plenty of men that did the same thing. But really, what it comes down to for me is confidence and the ability to have the same training opportunities. And previous to Secretary Carter's announcement, those training opportunities just weren't open. But for example, the cultural support team that I served with in Afghanistan, received assessment and selection, received prior training prior to deploying with my special forces team, and they acquitted themselves quite well, and we saw no issues with them at all. They always kept up. They were excellent. They were excellent marksmen, and there was no issue as far as any of the other personal issues that might, you know, happen with you know, men and women being on the same fire base. It didn't happen. My team had a strong moral compass. I had good men and good women on the team, and we accomplished the mission, and thankfully all came home.
Not all of them came home. In your article, you cite, is it Captain or Corporal Jennifer Moreno?
Captain, yes.
Captain Moreno and First Lieutenant Ashley White, who were supporting the Rangers on some raids.
Right.
Clearly not your usual behind-the-desk kind of a job.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And they played a vital role in that because, you know, the most common one was to, you know, segregate women and children on the battlefield. And sometimes they feel a little bit more comfortable talking with another female. So gaining information, they're an invaluable asset. But the other part of that, which I've discovered as a Special Forces Detachment Commander, was that when I was talking with, say, a village elder, we're two type A personalities. We're going at each other man on man. And then all of a sudden, I have two other women here, and his demeanor gets more relaxed, it's more calm, and they're able to have more of a civil discussion because this is something new and interesting to him. He wants to learn more about American culture and why we have women here serving with us alongside men. And so as that conversation opened up, they're able to not only elicit information, but they're able to gain agreement, and it helps the two parties relax and understand each other better.
Okay, so Marshall, are we really talking about the distinction, somewhat of a semantic distinction between equal opportunity and equality?
That's a good way of putting it. Equality, that's an interesting term, and it brings me to a point that I'd like to bring up here on your show. There was a lot of concern that the standards would be lowered I can tell you that the standards for the three officers that graduated Ranger School, Lisa Hester, Kristen Greist, and Shannon Haver, they weren't lowered. I'm a Ranger School graduate. There were some people who said that, well, they got multiple chances to go through phases of Ranger School. Well, I recycled two phases of Ranger School. It is a common occurrence. Less than 30% of Ranger School graduates actually make it all the way through on the first try. And then for the Special Forces assessment and selection, the only changes to the application were a raise of the GT score from a 107 to 110, so that affected all soldiers, and then any female applicants had to have a negative pregnancy test, and that was it. The physical fitness standards remain the same. The baseline Army standards of 49 push-ups, 59 sit-ups, and a 15-12 two-mile run, along with six pull-ups. And that is the minimum standard. I can tell you that the minimum standard is not going to get you through Special Forces assessment and selection, but that minimum standard was the same when I applied 6 years ago.
Okay, well, there we go. That's a great way to open up. Folks, we're talking with Marshall McGurk. He's a former Army Ranger, detachment commander, still a member of the Army Reserve. We're talking about women in the Special Forces. This is your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia. Stick around. Give us a call, 751-1041. We'll be right back.
Those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, back to the American Warrior.
Welcome back, folks. Your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia. We're talking about women in the Special Forces. We're joined with some direct frontline insight by Marshall McGurk. Marshall, Captain McGurk is a former Army Ranger Detachment Commander, still serves in the Army Reserves. Marshall, I'm afraid we forgot to issue the disclaimer, but these opinions represent the opinions of Marshall only, not the Department of Defense, Army, blah, 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 right?
We good? That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
Marshall, coming back to this now, there's, you know, we talked about equality versus equal opportunity. Is, I can tell one of the inherent issues of unfairness here is, at least in the, perhaps in the Army, I don't know about the other branches, but to some extent, the ability to be promoted, combat experience is a critical part of being able to gain those promotions in a timely manner. Is that a factor here as well, still, for women serving in combat operations?
What I saw over the last 15 years is that the combat experience varied, and really what it came down to was deployments. I've seen men and women, soldiers on the Army, is my experience, that had multiple deployments, and as long as they were competent in their job, received those good evaluations that they earned, then they had no issue getting promoted. For some folks, it may have been a little bit more difficult for them to be promoted if they didn't have a combat rotation. Earlier on when the war started, I would say about 2005, 2006, even upwards around 2008, there were maybe still some officers that were still trying to get overseas to get a deployment rotation. But now in 2016, From where I sat, it wasn't necessarily an issue. Okay. And as far as combat action is concerned, that was never really, from where I sat, again, it was never really seen as a must-have for promotion. It was more, you know, if you deployed overseas, be it Kuwait, Iraq, Afghanistan, you know, or another base overseas, it was mainly the professionalism and the competence in doing your job that was key to your success.
Okay, well, let's, Marshall, because you're a Ranger, you've earned the Ranger tab, and you alluded to it in the first segment. The proof is in the pudding. We have women who have graduated from Ranger School. I think at least two, maybe three so far.
That's correct. There were three.
Okay, and clarify for the listeners and like myself as a civilian, Ranger School is not just one school. There are several phases, correct?
That's correct. There are three phases of Ranger School. One held at Fort Benning, Georgia, the other in Dahlonega, Georgia, in the mountains, and then the last one in Florida called Swamp Phase. It's a 62-day course, but like I said, that 62-day clock can be reset at any time, given your performance in the various phases. So I spent a total of 108 days in Ranger School, and many other soldiers have spent an extended tour there as well.
So is there no point at which you don't make it, you're out?
Well, mainly for, you know, the common sense reasons, safety violations are obviously a big no-go there, as with any Army school. Anything that's morally and ethically incorrect will usually get you dropped from a military school. And then really it just depends on the individual soldier's timeline. Soldiers that are, you know, if they spend 6 months at that school, that's up to the school commandant and the school staff to determine with the soldier and with that soldier's gaining unit, you know, whether that soldier's going to be allowed to continue or if that soldier's going to be released to come back and try again.
Okay, so basically, Reader's Digest version, for these three women that have earned the Ranger tab, they've earned it, they've done it full bore. They've met every standard, they've gone through every class, and they graduated.
That's correct, and the standards were not lowered for anybody that was attending that course, including the physical standards.
Okay.
And I'd like to say that it's primarily a leadership school. The things that we do in the U.S. Army, the things that I did, your rucksack's going to weigh the same, regardless of who's carrying it. Your machine gun's going to weigh the same. A belt of 7.62 ammunition weighs 7 pounds, and that's a 100-round belt. And that doesn't change.
Well, okay. Now, but one of the other, when we talked about inequality, you had a very interesting article entitled, you know, Putting the Cart Before the Horse. Is this, so far, are we putting women, though, in that classic catch-22 situation somebody might find in the civilian world where you go in and they say, well, you don't have experience, and of course, well, how can I get experience unless you give me the opportunity to earn the experience? Is there sort of a similar situation going on right now as far as women in some of these special forces roles?
Well, right now, as far as being able to apply to go to the Ranger Regiment, to go to Ranger School, to go into Special Forces Assessment and Selection, I no longer believe that that's the case because this has been going on. This has been an issue for a couple years. The people that want the opportunity to volunteer, the people that have volunteered, have the same amount of time that the men had to train up and to know the standards and to know what they are. My issue with it in the beginning, and this is just me talking, you know, as, you know, just my own opinion, was that it could have been done a different way. For example, it could have been done where the officers, female officers, were sent through infantry officer basic course to learn more of the patrolling, to learn more of the small unit tactics and the on-the-ground leadership skills. And Ranger School is primarily a leadership school, but I believe those traits are inherent throughout every job in the military. Was it a situation where it could have been done different? Potentially, they might have had more training. That's true. However, looking at the flip side of the coin, other, you know, the argument could have been made that they were receiving special treatment, and given that Ranger School is primarily a leadership school and that men from all branches within the Army had attended, then, you know, I think the decision was made to, you know, require pre-Ranger training, which is a standard in a lot of units, and then send them off to Ranger School. So when I did write that article, that was the issue that I was trying to make, that potentially sending them through some type of infantry training first might have been more beneficial. But, you know, I eat my humble pie because the women went out there and they did it and they succeeded.
But it's important to recognize, and you say this in the article, the distinction in Ranger School, it's not a place to learn fieldcraft techniques, it's a place to hone them. And if women haven't had the full opportunity to learn, get those basic techniques down, then to some extent they were starting a little bit behind the ball, weren't they?
Yeah, they were a little bit. Again, you know, I was having this discussion with some of my peers, and they, you know, they reminded me that there was officers, male officers from other branches in the service support side of things, ordnance officers, transportation officers, who did not have as much field craft as combat arms officers. However, they were able to go to Ranger School and succeed, and I remember a few that graduated with me. So
you feel that from the time you wrote that article to now, that issue has been addressed or is being addressed?
It is. It is. And it's being addressed by the opening of all those combat positions to women. So now women have the opportunity to volunteer. And I recently read an article that a woman from New Mexico is actually one of the first to enlist in the infantry.
Okay.
Read that this morning on social media, actually.
Okay, well, good for her, and we wish her luck and her service to our country. Folks, again, I'm talking with Marshall McGurk. He's a former Army Ranger Detachment Commander. He still continues to serve in the Army Reserves. He's been out there in the field. He's commanded both men and women, and we're talking about women in the Special Forces. There's been a change in the rules, and now enough time has passed where we're starting to see that kind of integration there. Marshall, when we come back after the break, I'd like to talk about just the practical physics and biology involved with some of these issues when we come back. Folks, again, we're live in studio. Feel free to give us a call, 751-1041. This is your host, Ben Bueller-Garcia. Hey, check us out on Facebook, American Warrior Daily Mail. All these shows, podcasts, and special offers available at AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, back to the American Warrior.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. We're talking about women in the Special Forces. We're joined live on the phone by Marshall McGurk. Marshall is a former Army Ranger Detachment Commander. And you just heard the El Charro ad. That means it's time for our El Charro Family Restaurant, Sir Yes Sir, Caller of the Week. We haven't reduced the standards. You got to be first in line. First caller with a question or comment for our guest receives a $20 gift card to the great El Charro Steak. Ladies and gentlemen, some of the best steak I've ever had in my life. Give us a call, 751-1041. Marshall, back to you. In my day job, I often work with situations where it's glaringly clear the distinction between the people writing the regulations and those that have to implement them. One example was a small restaurant that was looking to rezone, and the folks back at City Hall said, no, you put the dumpster here and the big 18-wheel truck should be able to still make it. But on the ground, anybody with any common sense could just look at that and say, it ain't going to happen. In this case, let's be honest. There are clearly physical differences between men and women. 155-millimeter artillery shell weighs 103 pounds, and I'm assuming...
Correct.
You're going to want to fire more than one of them.
The RAND
did a survey, and let me just quote one of the survey responders. He's a Green Beret that says, this endeavor is a complete waste of time. Filling out this survey is just another example of how administrative issues such as sensitivity or gender training or other surveys will take away from my training time. I could list hundreds of reasons why women cannot do the job a Green Beret is required to do, but as I have only 1,000 characters, I will choose the one that I think is the most important. A woman cannot physically do what I can do. I weigh 225 pounds, 280 pounds in full kit, as did most of the members of my ODA. I expect every person on my team to be able to drag any member of my team out of a firefight. A 130-pound female could not do it. I don't care how much time she spends in the gym. Marshall, you've been out there. You have served in the Special Forces. To what extent is it essential that every team member be able to do every job?
It's essential that we're able to do our baseline job. As far as doing every job, that survey responded did have an important point. Physical fitness is a hallmark of what we do, especially, in Special Forces. It was an absolute hallmark of what we did. And our feet carried us everywhere. Our feet carried us everywhere, and our backs carried everything that we had. But I would respond to that by saying that there are women out there who can do it. Now, have any volunteered? There have been two that have volunteered to attend Special Forces Assessment and Selection. I don't know if they've currently started training or if they've started the course, but I know that there have been two that have been, paperboarded and asked to show up at Fort Bragg to begin training. Are they physically capable of doing it? I believe so, because we're not the only people that carry heavy rucksacks on our back. There were infantrymen, there's military police, there's EOD techs. My brother was an EOD tech, and he had women in his unit, and they were required to put on that bomb suit and to run with it and to perform a lot of physical activity in it, including dragging their comrade away, who was also wearing a bomb suit. So I believe that, some of those things are comparable. And having actually seen them done, and actually having seen women carry stretchers with men on them, heavy men, I believe they can do it. Now, have people stepped up to do it? There'll be a few, and it's going to take a while. Have they stepped up right now? Well, three graduated Ranger School. But there are physical differences, but I believe that, with time and with the right standard that, training can accomplish a lot. It may take them a little bit longer to get up to the physical fitness standard. And I got it. You cannot change men and women's physiology. But given that they're already doing other jobs in combat, I believe that that's really going to be a non-issue.
Well, and so clearly it sounds like we definitely agree on this factors. One is, again, it's equal opportunity. If the standards don't change, because these are standards that keep people alive in combat.
Correct.
So as long as the
Correct.
Standards don't change, if anyone can meet those standards and they have an equal opportunity to meet those standards, we're good to go.
Correct. And I would go back to the point of There are a lot of men who try out for Special Forces Assessment and Selection. There are a lot of men who try out for Ranger School, and they fail to make it. They fail to make it for a number of reasons: leadership skills, their tactical acumen, and physical fitness. Physical fitness is not defined on how somebody looks. It is defined a lot by willpower, and by how mentally tough they are. And I believe that there are, you know, mentally tough men and women that can do the training, and there are plenty of them that already do it.
Now, Marshall, let's address one of the other things that comes up very often in this discussion that I think is valid whether we like it or not: unit cohesion. I've been very active for years now with a support group for the USS Tucson, which is a fast attack submarine. And when the Navy also decided they're going to integrate women into the submarine service, it was interesting to me that the biggest pushback that I heard was from the wives of the sailors on a fast attack submarine. Now, I don't know if you've ever been on one of those boats, Marshall, but there's absolutely no privacy. It's very close quarters. Are there some situations where just the practicality of it relative to biology doesn't make sense?
Well, for me personally, no, because I've lived that practicality. I had women on my fire base, and the infantry company that was adjacent to me on the same fire base had women in supporting roles as cooks, as mechanics, and as intelligence analysts. And so, you know, did we have necessarily separate facilities for them? We had separate facilities marked, and the biggest thing that I saw was that it's a leadership issue. My team, like I said, had a strong moral compass, and it had nothing to do with me. They had a strong moral compass before I showed up to take command. But my team sergeant, my warrant officer, and I were all in agreement that if one of those guys or any of us did something that negatively affected the team in a moral or ethical way, then it was going to be dealt with swiftly. And they were usually going to be sent back to, the company headquarters to have whatever investigation happen. All the men on my team were married, minus one. And all of them loved their wives and were extremely loyal. So I was really fortunate. I know other units, they may have to deal with some of those moral, ethical issues. But I truly believe that it's a leadership issue, similar with money, similar with people who handle money overseas. They make bones about, well, you know, there's always people stealing money. That's true. But we hear about those stories because they get caught and they're swiftly dealt with and they're swiftly punished if they're guilty of what they're doing. Again, we've been at war for 15 years. Men and women have been on the same fire bases, the same big bases, the same combat outposts, over the last decade and a half. Have there been incidents? Sure. I'm sure there have. But they've been investigated, and, you know, people, if they need to be sent home, they're sent home.
Okay. Let's go to our caller. Mark, you're the winner of the Charo Steak card as the first caller today. What is your question or comment for our guest, Marshall McGurk?
Yeah, it's been very interesting, and I've got some interesting parts to this myself. I'm an Air Force helicopter pilot, and I went to training with the Army, plenty of Rangers who entertained me magnificently telling me Ranger school stories. And I was literally on the floor laughing so hard about how that went. But I had a huge respect for them. And in fact, I even went to war planner school with a fellow pilot out of the 160th. So,
wow,
I've hung around with the Army some, and when I was a 141 pilot here, we hauled little birds all over the place. So, anyway,
wow, that's incredible.
So I consider myself, and I've flown with female pilots and had female loadmasters and flight engineers and whatever. So I've had, you know, female crew members a good part of my career there, but I consider myself open-minded but concerned here a bit. And one of the things that keeps, you know, getting to me in the kind of the back of my mind is, you know, are special forces operations compatible with, you know, I'll call it female hygiene requirements? I mean, have they figured out how to make that work? And, you know, have we taken any lessons from some other organizations like the Israelis, I think, who's had, you know, female combat members maybe longer than us?
Okay, interesting take. Mark, thanks for your call. We've got information. Let's let Marshall answer offline here.
Mark, hey, first, thanks for the question. That's a great question, and I have a great appreciation for Air Force pilots and helicopter pilots because you're really tough and mentally tough to do that job. Specifically with that question, I'm not a medical professional, and I'm going to start with that right off the bat. I had multiple women on my fire base over my nine-month deployment to Afghanistan, first with the cultural support team and then with the female engagement team. There were instances where we were outside of the wire for, you know, a couple days at a time. And the hygiene requirements, that comes down to the individual. The way we addressed it was that it was always an individual responsibility, and that if it was your responsibility to keep yourself clean. And because, you know, injuries can happen in a lot of different forms. If a cut's not taken care of, you're going to get an infection. You get an infection, you're a detriment to the team. I know it sounds really simple, and I know that's a simplified answer, but I never saw any issues with it. As far as any supplies that men or women may have needed, be it a man or a woman, everybody's going to need toilet paper or baby wipes. And so that's just the nature of what we do. And that's how we addressed it, and it was never an issue for us. So I believe that, you know, as more people go through this, they'll find more of those field craft techniques to make their field experience safe and at least tolerable, you know, and I don't foresee any issue as far as hygiene requirements go. One thing that we did on the fire base with showers was that we had specific times where we shut the showers off to the females only, and we had Afghan counterparts living on our base. We let them know that, you know, those two showers were reserved for the women at those times, and they had no issue at all. So, again, it's a leadership issue. As long as it's addressed and as long as people feel safe, then there should be no problems. And if there are problems, they should be swiftly dealt with.
And, Mark, thanks for your call. Great answer, Marshall. We've got about a minute before the next break. One question, when we talk about that leadership, one of the challenges I foresee here is a cultural – the time – and the energy it's going to take to make a cultural shift, particularly in the Special Forces community, as far as accepting women into their ranks. If they make it, they qualified, good. But, Marshall, do you think there still is going to be some time we need to sort of work through that cultural shift?
There are, and it's really rewiring people's mental makeup on how to see this issue. My team, again, had a strong moral compass, and the way we viewed it was we're never going to refuse extra guns on our team. So, you know, be they a man or a woman, be they a dog handler or a cultural support team member, someone shows up, they better be competent, they better be physically fit, and they better know their job. As long as they know those things, they can be a member of the team as long as they can stay on the fire base.
Well,
if they don't have those things, then, you know, we do the appropriate counseling, and if they don't make the cut, we would send it back to headquarters.
There we go. Well and generously spoken. Folks, your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia. I'm joined by Marshall McGurk. We're talking about women in the Special Forces. We got one more segment. Feel free to give us a call, 751-1041.
My daddy served in the Army. We lost his right eye, but he flew a flag out in our yard. Till the day that he died, he wanted my mother, my brother, my sister and me to grow up and live happy in the land of the free.
If you want to discuss those who serve the red, white, and blue, dial 520-751-1041. Now, back to the American Warrior.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to American Warrior Radio. This is your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia. We're joined live on the phone by Marshall McGurk. Marshall is a former commander, Army Ranger. He wears the Army Ranger tab. He's also a West Point graduate. We're talking about the decision to open up all combat arms positions to women, but we're mostly focusing on Special Forces. Is that kind of the topic summary here, Marshall? We good?
Yep, you got it perfectly, Ben. You got it perfect.
And one of your Havoc Journal articles, the headline was Band Together and Welcome Women into Combat Arms. You wrote that last September. Let me finish up this last segment, Marshall, with quoting one of the greatest philosophers of our modern times. Yoda said, do or do not, there is no try. The difference between, yes, let's go out and do this, and being given the resources and the authority to do this. I've noticed, and you actually, you had another article in Havoc Journal called Blunting the Tip of the Spear, talking about how our Special Forces are involved in one of their highest deployment tempos ever. Training budgets, as far as I can tell from the 2017 budgets, are remaining static. How does one integrate such a major step as gender integration without being given some additional money to do so, and how does that impact the maintenance of the quality levels of our current special forces?
Well, from where I sat as a detachment commander, the decision cost nothing. It costs nothing additional to put an additional member on my team, be they male or female. It costs nothing additional for somebody to attend the training and to pass. It costs nothing additional to go out to the range to train and to go to our various training locations, you know, and to do those training concepts. So for me, the decision, you know, to allow women into special forces from where I sat as a detachment commander, you know, cost nothing. Now, I'm sure at the higher levels there may have been some other costs associated with that. But, you know, going all the way back to the previous question about hygiene costs, every building, you know, its standard code has male and female restrooms, you know, standard shower codes, you know, et cetera. You know, and from there, it's, you know, having the positions open, they were already open to men anyway. So whoever fills that position is the person that, you know, that passed training and who's confident at their job. So, really, it's just a matter of doing it. It is a real leadership issue, and it is going to be an absolute leadership challenge because people will be forced to prove themselves. We have a saying in the Special Forces that, you know, assessment and selection is only the beginning, and that you are selected and assessed every day. And so there are going to be men and women that struggle with that. The women especially, unfortunately, we're coming around to another one of those periods in our history, where more may be asked of people than what may be, you know, seen as fair, but it's the nature of trying to make it acceptable. Now that the order's been actually given, and that women can volunteer, you know, I liken it back to, you know, the 442nd Combat Regiment, you know, the Japanese Americans. I liken it back to African American struggles going into the military. There were people who thought that because of race, that African Americans were not as physically fit, not as mentally tough, and not as intelligent. And they thought the same of the Japanese. You know, now 2016, that seems silly. But there were people who were, you know, forced to endure a lot in order to prove themselves. And I think we're at a, you know, another point in our history, you know, again as well. And it, like I said, it's a leadership issue. It's the order's been given. I'd also like to liken it to, what was it about 15, maybe 20 years ago, when the Citadel and the Virginia Military Institute were integrated. It was seen that the Citadel, you know, especially after the first female who entered there after she quit during the basic training portion, you know, there was new footages of the male cadets, you know, running wild in the campus, you know, in celebration. Whereas you go to the Virginia Military Institute and a commandant at the time, Major General Bunting, issued a statement to the school and really to the world that his institution, the Virginia Military Institute, was going to do it right and was going to do it in a professional way. And they had no issues in the press and they had no issues on campus. So it's a matter of people taking charge, knowing what the order is and ensuring people meet the standards.
You know, Marshall, I'm glad you brought that up because I think it's important for us to recognize that when we talk about fairness and equality to the, you know, the Navy SEALs now open to women as well on paper. To the best of my knowledge, again, to the best of my knowledge, no one has yet stepped up to go through BUDS, but I'm guessing that that first woman or that first group of women, there's going to be an incredible burden of the media scrutiny, the expectations, the pressure, you know, you're the first one in, you know, don't be the first one to let us down, the first one to fail.
Correct.
And you kind of alluded to that, Marshall. You that's just, I guess there's no way of avoiding that, is there?
No, there really isn't. You know, and like you alluded to, Ben, the pressure is going to come from both sides. You know, a lot of people deal with that individual pressure. You know, I'm the first one in my family to go to college, not me specifically, but say that's the case. Oh, I'm the first one in my family to become an officer. I'm the first one in my family to go to special forces training. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to let the family down. Well, imagine that on a wider scale. You know, I'm the first woman to attend the Citadel, the first woman to attend West Point, the first woman to attend Ranger School. You know, that takes an amount of mental toughness that really is unfathomable to a lot of people. And I know there's a lot of consideration for the physical fitness levels, but that mental toughness level, I can assure you that the first women who do go through that training, special forces training, BUDS, et cetera, are going to be some of the most mentally tough people that you'll ever meet. And I hope, you know, someday that we get a chance to meet and work with them.
You know, and I'm glad you said that. That's a perfect grant, because I'm sure both of us have, we've met those women and we know they're out there. And I have absolutely no doubt that the first woman to undergo SEALS training are going to be some of the toughest people out there, male or female, no one excluded. So, Marshall, thank you so much for joining us here on American Warrior today. Folks, you can check out some great stuff by Marshall and others at havocjournal.com. Marshall, 15 seconds. Any last thoughts?
Well, hey, Ben, thanks a lot for the call. I really appreciate your support of the military. Havoc Journal at havocmedia.com is our email address, or havocjournal.com. And I really appreciate the support that you give our military and the American public at large.
Well, it's truly my pleasure. Folks, another great show. Like I said, visit us at AmericanWarriorRadio.com for podcasts, expanded show notes, and special offers from our advertisers. You can find us on Facebook, American Warrior Radio, on Twitter, or at Warrior Radio TUC. Find us on iTunes, Stitcher.com, even on the Roku player streaming device at the Nowherecast. Until next time, all policies and procedures that remain in place.